Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. Last week, a federal judge granted a motion to dismiss and strike a lawsuit brought by X Corp, formerly known as Twitter, against a nonprofit research outfit called the Center for Countering Digital Hate, or CCDH. CCDH has caused a lot of trouble for platforms such as X and Meta over the years, mostly by doing a couple of things well: pointing out when the platforms host false and hateful content, and when they fail to uphold their own policies. If that's your mission, there is always work to do, and such failures appear to be increasingly frequent at X since the billionaire Elon Musk bought the company. Concern over the material and failures that are described in CCDH's reports appear to have contributed to decline in advertising revenues at the company. But this isn't just about business. Musk himself once referred to CCDH as truly evil, joining a list of detractors that includes various right-wing figures and media personalities. The lawsuit was seen as potentially significant for the field of independent researchers who seek to understand and in some cases hold to account major technology companies. While X says it plans to appeal, the motion filed by U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California Judge Charles Breyer was, as Brian Fung at CNN put it, an excoriating rebuke. In today's episode, we're going to hear from three guests in two segments. In the first, I speak to Alex Abdo, the litigation director at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, about the case and why it matters. And in the second, I speak to Imran Ahmed, CEO and founder of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, and Roberta Kaplan, a partner at the law firm of Kaplan, Hecker & Fink that represented CCDH in this matter. First up, here's Alex Abdo.
I'm Alex Abdo. I'm the litigation director at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University.
So Alex, the Knight Institute joined the ACLU, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, in filing an amicus brief in X Corp v. CCDH. What were your primary interests in doing so?
Well, we explained in our amicus brief that independent research focus on the tech platforms is enormously important right now. And the legal theory that X Corp was pursuing against the Center for Countering Digital Hate would endanger a lot of that research. Because if X Corp had prevailed, it would have created the risk that a lot of independent research, which relies on very similar methodology to what CCDH was doing, would be imperiled, would be subject to lawsuits trying to impose millions or tens of millions of dollars in potential liability. And we were concerned about that, and that's why we were excited to join with the ACLU and EFF in filing that amicus brief.
You had three key arguments. I want to just touch on each one. The first was, I guess, your bread and butter. It was arguing essentially that this might chill or stifle speech. Can you talk a little bit about how you established that in your brief?
Kind of interesting thing about X Corp's lawsuit is that it in part characterized the legal effort as being about the safety and security of X Corp's users. But all of the damages that they were seeking, all of the harm that they were complaining of, stemmed not from any alleged breach of security or safety of their users, but from speech that CCDH engaged in that was critical of X Corp. And so what X Corp was really trying to do was punish CCDH for its speech. And so that's what we are trying to convince the court of, is to understand the suit for what it was, which was an attack on protected speech, an effort to deter important and constitutionally protected research into the tech platforms. And the court ultimately agreed with that. And in its opening paragraph, it had a pretty unusually candid opening, saying sometimes it's hard to figure out what's really motivating litigation, but not in this case. This is an effort by X Corp to punish speech. And that framing, I think, ended up being really helpful for the court in untangling the somewhat complicated legal thicket that X Corp was trying to throw up. It saw through all of that and recognized the suit for what it was, which was, again, an attack on free speech and important research.
But this isn't just about the First Amendment. There's an awful lot of mention of California law in your brief, the California Constitution, California's anti-SLAPP law. How did you apply California law in your brief?
In a couple of different ways. One important principle is that you can't sue somebody for defamation unless you can establish that their speech is untrue and that they acted recklessly with respect to the truth of their speech. And that principle actually comes from the First Amendment. Even though those are limitations on state defamation law, the Supreme Court has made clear that the First Amendment sets an outer bar to defamation liability and requires defamation plaintiffs to show that the speech they're complaining about is untrue. Now, X Corp did not sue CCDH for defamation, but the Supreme Court has said and lower courts have recognized that plaintiffs cannot creatively plead their way around the First Amendment limit on defamation law by relying on some other kind of state tort or state basis for liability when what they are really complaining about is speech. And so what we argued in our brief is that even though X Corp did not sue for defamation, the torts it was complaining about, the California causes of action that it was suing under, were effectively trying to hold CCDH liable for its speech and so should be subject to the same First Amendment limit requiring X Corp to plead and prove CCDH's speech was false, which X Corp, you know, very conspicuously did not allege. They didn't try to show that CCDH's speech was false. And it would have been very hard for them to demonstrate that because what CCDH was relying on in their research, you know, was all publicly available and verifiable posts made on their platform. So that was, I think, the key way in which we approached the state causes of action in the amicus brief. The other argument we made was that it would have been a violation of California public policy for the court to enforce terms of service, which the company claimed CCDH had violated, to enforce those terms of service against CCDH for engaging in public interest investigations of the platform. And this is a doctrine that is probably unfamiliar to most people outside of the law. Most people would assume if you have a contract with someone, you can always enforce it. But that's not actually true. Courts recognize an exception to the enforceability of contracts when enforcing a contract would violate some source of public policy, state public policy or federal public policy. And we argued that that exception, which is a relatively limited one, has an important application in a case like this, where the underlying conduct being challenged is, again, public interest research. Research that is trying to contribute to public discourse about one of the most important forums for discourse today, X Corp's platform. So those are the, you know, arguments that we focused on in the brief when it came to California's state law.
You also make a defense of scraping as a tool that independent researchers need to use, should be able to use. You make mention, at least in the footnote, of a prior case, the NYU Ad Observatory's conflict with Meta over using a scraping mechanism to study online advertising on Facebook in the run-up to the 2020 election and the period after the 2020 election. What aspect of kind of the concern over scraping stood out for you here?
It turns out that scraping is one of the basic news gathering methods in the digital world. It is the way that digital journalists, data journalists, tech journalists, it is the way that they make sense of our digital environment. In analog era reporting, journalists walk on the street, take photographs, take video, read memos and documents, things that they can collect. And that's the kind of analog era version of public reporting. In the digital environment, the way that you see is by going on these platforms, but also by using digital tools to study these digital platforms. And the main digital tool that researchers and journalists use is scraping, which is really just using a computer to collect information, generally publicly available information, which is what CCDH was alleged to have scraped. I think they were alleged to have scraped 9,500 publicly available tweets on X Corp's platform. And the reason why we focused on that in our brief is that we wanted the court to appreciate that if it found that a research organization could be held liable for using the what we think of as a very basic tool of digital investigation, then most of the independent research and journalism that the public relies on to understand these new platform environments would be illegal. It'd be illegal for researchers and journalists to do this work. And that was what we were so concerned about. And you referred to the AdObserver case, and just as a matter of full disclosure, I was involved in representing Laura Edelson and Damon McCoy in their individual capacities in that conflict. But that never got to litigation. That was a case where Meta sent a threatening letter to Laura and Damon based on their research into political advertisements on Facebook's platform. And it raised a lot of the same concerns. But fortunately, it never got to litigation. X Corp's suit, in contrast, I think is the first suit that I'm aware of filed by a major platform against researchers engaged in public interest investigations. And so this was, in the independent research community, really a moment that we had all been worried would come about when a major platform tried to leverage its terms of service to shut down the ways in which the public can make sense of the digital world. And that's why this case was so important, and why it's great that CCDH got such a decisive ruling from the court, the federal court in California, dismissing X Corp's lawsuit. And I hope X Corp doesn't appeal. I think it would be a mistake for them to appeal. But if they do, I feel fairly confident that the Ninth Circuit will side with CCDH in the same way that the district court did.
I want to ask maybe a slightly messy question as a kind of concluding one. This lawsuit is connected to many other things that you've been working on for the last couple of years. There are ties from this to Murthy v. Missouri. There are ties from this to Jim Jordan's Select Committee on the Weaponization of the Federal Government. There are ties to a broader set of activities that have been aimed at trying to silence or discourage independent research. What do you make of this overall landscape of things when you look at this particular event, this ruling in this case, alongside the rest of it?
It's a great question. I don't know that I'll be entirely up to the task of answering it adequately, but let me try it in this way. We are in a moment of great technological change where so many of the forums and venues and services that we have relied on historically have been moving online. And so it's not surprising that there's a power. It's a kind of moment where people are trying to seize power over these new environments. You have major companies that have dominated the platforms. They're the ones who have constructed them, operate them, collected the data of their users to monetize. You have legislatures now trying to rush in too, either through legislation, trying to assert regulatory power over these environments, or through congressional investigations, trying to exert their influence over what is going on over these platforms. And you have courts now deciding, trying to wrestle with the relationship between these new platforms and democracy. And so it's not surprising that with so much being contested in this shift, we're seeing this messy fight over who is going to control the platforms, what can be said on the platforms, what will be heard and amplified on the platforms, and what can be known about them through independent research and journalism. And I think that is what connects all of the free speech fights that we're seeing in the courts, which are all, at the end of the day, targeted at, you know, these platforms in one way or another, these enormously concentrated platforms where you have a handful of people deciding so much about society and democracy. I think that's what connects them. And what I hope at the end of the day from all of these cases is that we emerge with a set of rules that draws an appropriate boundary between private forums for discourse and the government, that recognizes that the government does have a role, but not an excessive one, in regulating these platforms. And that also, and this is maybe the crucial point that CCDH's case raises, that also denies the companies the power to decide what the public is allowed to know about these new and enormously important forums for speech. We didn't have to think about this in the these kinds of questions in quite the same way in the analog world, because it was so obvious in the analog world that the First Amendment protects journalists when they take photographs of police interacting with protesters or when they're doing gumshoe journalism. It's a little bit less obvious in the digital world just because it's new what kinds of investigative methods our commitment to free speech should protect. CDH's cases, I think, is the leading edge of that fight. And it's, I think, enormously important that the district court recognize this case for what it is and upheld the right of CDH to engage in its important work.
Alex, I'm sure I'll find you at the center of many future conflicts and suits that emerge out of this patchwork that you've just described. So I'm grateful to you for speaking to me today.
Thanks for having me, Justin. Great to talk.
Next up, we're going to hear from the CEO and founder of the Center for Countering Digital Hate and the lawyer that represented him against Elon Musk's X.
Hi, my name's Imran Ahmed. I'm CEO and founder of the Center for Countering Digital Hate.
My name's Roberta Kaplan. Everyone calls me Robbie, and I'm a partner at the law firm of Kaplan, Hecker, and Fink.
I thank you both for joining me today. So when I opened this decision, these words from U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer in San Francisco, just an amazing opening paragraph in this ruling. I want to read it out loud. Sometimes it is unclear what is driving a litigation, and only by reading between the lines of a complaint can one attempt to surmise a plaintiff's true purpose. Other times a complaint is so unabashedly and vociferously about one thing that there can be no mistaking that purpose. This case represents the latter circumstance. This case is about punishing the defendants for their speech. Imran, how did you feel when you read that paragraph?
You know, you asked me how I feel. The truth is that I didn't, you know, I knew that to be true. And so I was glad and gratified to see that the judge had recognized it. I was unsurprised given that in the hearing it was quite clear the direction he was taking. But I was also incredibly grateful to the American justice system, which I think has, you know, has had to bear a lot of burdens in the last few years, in particular post January the 6th. I was very glad to have an American justice system that works, because it showed that even the world's richest man versus a minuscule nonprofit, we are all treated as equals. And I felt seen.
Robbie, how about you? You have a history of taking on rich men who often want to defend themselves in the courts. What did this read like to you?
So, you know, as a lawyer, I think all lawyers feel this way, but I think I feel it particularly strongly. The best kind of judge that you can possibly get in any case is a judge who, quote unquote, reads between the lines. That's because you want a judge in any case to see what's really at issue, to see the fundamental equities or lack of equity between the parties, and to understand what's really going on. So as someone who spends their whole life like putting in briefs and site-checking briefs and doing what I do day after day after day, to get a decision like this that basically says in plain, simple English exactly, not only exactly what is true in this case, but exactly, in my view, what courts should be doing, which is really understanding what's really going on in every case, was a tremendous, how should I put it? I had to pretty much stop myself from jumping up and down. It was just a delight and an honor.
As far as this particular complaint, are you entirely out of the clear at this point?
He said he's going to, Elon and X Corp have said that they intend to appeal. Whether or not they do that, in my mind at least, is very much in question, because if they do appeal, they will lose. And when they lose, they will be liable to Imran for his attorney's fees there as well. So I'm not so sure they will appeal, but they do get an appeal if they choose to exercise that right.
We've been really clear. Bring it on. We'll beat them again. And in one respect, I don't know how long he wants the pain and embarrassment to endure of being labeled as a thin-skinned tyrant who uses lawfare to try and silence his critics, given that He wants to sort of promulgate his image of being a free speech champion. Go for it, guy. Go for it.
It's also an honor to have a client who's even more aggressive in standing up to bullies than I am, and that says something.
A lot of folks have pointed out the kind of hypocrisy in Elon Musk's stance in this matter, as well as in other perhaps related matters, brandishing himself a free speech champion, and at the same time essentially trying to use the law to essentially shut down the speech of independent researchers such as yourself. Robbie, I might ask you, what do you think this ruling says for independent researchers more generally in this space?
So what I hope it says, and I can't say it's an amazing victory, but our system still allows people to bring cases. So it's not we can't give anyone a complete victory because people can still file lawsuits. But what it says is that anyone who intends to file a lawsuit like this, including X Corp again or any other social media company, seeking essentially to punish an outside entity who is doing open, clear research into the content on your site, then you should know now that there's a very prestigious, very good, very smart judge in the Northern District of California who has said that kind of a lawsuit is offensive to our justice system, that it violates California's anti-SLAPP law, which, as I said before, means that there's a fee-shifting mechanism in place, and that courts are going to see through the lines. Again, quoting his language, they're going to read between the lines, and they're going to see what's really at stake, and you're not going to win. So you might as well just throw your money away. Better, don't bring the lawsuit in the first place.
There were a number of different aspects of X's complaint. They invoked the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. They tried to use contract law to retaliate against you. What does this ruling tell us about whether those types of strategies will work in future?
I want Imran to say something more because he'll have more of a sense of kind of the on-the-ground realities in the situation. But from a legal perspective, I think the key issue here was the consumer. No, the federal statute, the computer statute, was silly. It clearly didn't apply to what happened here. So we were never really at all worried about that claim. The claim that I think had the greatest legs, although I still don't think it had any legs, was the contract claim. And that's because X Corp, like many other companies, have terms of service which prevent scraping. Most social media companies actually define what scraping means so that people who sign their terms of service can have a good understanding of what they're supposed to do and what they're not supposed to do. X Corp has still never defined that term. But I think we made very persuasive arguments to the court. One, that taking public tweets off of Twitter, no proprietary information, no confidential information, just public tweets that people post cannot possibly be scraping. And the judge dealt with that in a footnote where he said it can't possibly be that Twitter's concern here is that a neo-Nazi who posts anti-Semitic content on Twitter should have the unlimited right to take that off and no one will know what he or she posted. And two, this is what he really relied on, but it's probably equally as strong. The idea that someone signing onto that toss or clicking onto that toss could possibly think that the foreseeable damages to taking, again, public tweets off of Twitter were the loss of advertising, millions of dollars in loss of advertising, is insane. And under contract law, in every state that I'm aware of in this country, your damages have to be foreseeably arising out of the contract. And obviously, using Twitter and looking at public tweets does not mean that if Coca-Cola or Heinz Ketchup starts advertising on Twitter, that's my fault.
There's a bit of me that I feel two things right now, Justin. For 9 months now, I haven't been able to talk about the specific nature of the claims or our responses to them or the facts that underpin our response to the claims, because that's been something that I've been discussing with Robbie, and that's covered by privilege. And so we've been very cautious not to discuss or disclose how those discussions, what was happening in those discussions. And now that I can talk about them, I actually don't want to. There's when I'm in at CCDH, one of the things that we talk about, that I say frequently to my staff, is don't talk about the memes, look for the themes. For example, in the pandemic, when we were doing analysis of anti-vax work, we said there's only three themes that underpin all of these myriad memes that come out. One is COVID isn't dangerous. Two is that vaccines are dangerous. Three is that you can't trust doctors or the establishment. And that is a crucial insight. Now, what is so powerful about the judge is that he seems to have imbibed that aphorism. And he's seen through all the memes, all the nonsense, all the CFAA claims. They stole passwords. They scraped data. They broke contracts. They did this. They did that. They made me lose $100 million. And he just said, you just don't want them to talk anymore, do you? I get it. You don't like what they say and the way that they say it and the fact that people trust them and believe them. And I think that's what was so important about the claims that he made. They were all nonsense. They were all utterly nonsensical. And you're dealing with my wife and I, we're hoping to have an addition to the family soon. So I've been reading lots of parenting books. And what does it mean when your child is crying? In this instance, if a child's not crying for any logical reason, it's not trying to communicate something to you apart from the fact that in this instance, the child, Elon, has shit its pants. And that's why it's upset. He shit his pants. He cries about it. Unfortunately, he's a billionaire, so he gets to sue us at the same time.
So putting that characterization of what's happened here to one side, it is part of a kind of broader set of things that are happening in the world that are all more or less about targeting independent researchers who study mis and disinformation, who study the health of the information ecosystem, who study questions around information integrity. I can't help but read this lawsuit and certainly many other actions by Elon Musk as essentially being in league with a kind of broader movement to try to hold researchers such as yourself, such as myself, to account for these things. What other fronts are you fighting at the moment? This is not the only issue you've had to deal with in the last couple of months.
And we've had Jim Jordan's committee, his subcommittee on weaponization of the federal government, subpoenaing us and asking for all of our, he asked for all of our contracts with the US government. There weren't any. All of our correspondence with the executive branch of the federal government, which we handed over, and all of our correspondence with tech companies. And what he was hoping to find was some evidence of collusion, that we were secretly part of the deep state. He couldn't find any, so he's gone quiet. We've had Stephen Miller FOIing every single department in government, trying to see if they've got correspondence with us, but that will prove that we're part of the deep state. They haven't found anything. We've had journalists who are connected to Elon Musk, for example, Matt Taibbi, Michael Schellenberger, Paul Thacker, all writing pieces about us. Some of them have been ludicrously incompetent. One of them decided to go through my CV to work out that, because he was convinced I'm an MI6 agent, which is the British Security Service, Intelligence Services, James Bond. So he went through my CV saying, look, he studied war studies at King's College London. He went to Somalia. He ran for election as a Conservative Member of Parliament. It wasn't my CV. It was the CV of Imran Ahmed Khan, who was a Conservative Member of Parliament. He submitted that to Congress as evidence, saying, look, I've just proven this guy's an MI6 agent. I've been dealing with being chased by the Three Stooges, Laurel and Hardy, every single comedy duo, trio you can think of for the last few months. But what we've had to do is remain professional and disciplined throughout the whole thing. This has all been a test of our professionalism and discipline. I feel very little about the lawsuit. I am very proud of the organization and the team that I've built, because they have really shone in this period, and also, of course, of the exceptional counsel we've received from Roberta and John and Matt and the rest of the team at Kaplan Hecker and Fink.
I'm pretty sure, I guess your listeners can't see us, but I'm pretty sure that there is no British Secret Service agent who would wear that sweater, Imran. I would go out on a limb and say that.
It's cozy. Yeah, no, it's embarrassingly non-Secret Service-y, isn't it?
Yeah, James Bond definitely would never have worn it.
This is great. I actually did. I worked in Parliament many years ago, and I did meet a spy once, a very senior member of the intelligence services. And I said to him, halfway through talking to him, I was like, I've just got this horrible vision of you standing over me one day as I wake up with like a towel and a bucket of water. And he said to me, oh, no, dear boy, we wouldn't have to do that. You're a talker. So, you know, Yeah, I wouldn't make a very good spy. I do like chatting, so.
So let me ask you this then. What advice would you give
the executive directors of other organizations that are out there right now gearing up to study various phenomena related to mis and disinformation, various phenomena related to elections that are coming up here in the US, potentially, I understand, in the UK, certainly in Europe and other parts of the world coming soon. What would you tell them as they prepare perhaps to face the same types of complaints that you've faced here?
The work that we do is profoundly important. Last week, we put out a report on how abortion disinformation is being spread via Meta and Google platforms in the developing world, in the global south, which vitiates the right to good information about abortion, sexual reproductive health for millions of people. That's important. But if we can fix that, that will change lives. It will help people. The work that we're doing on identity-based hate, on election disinformation, is all important. We put out a report a few weeks ago looking at the way that image generators can be abused, and one of the platforms has already responded. The work that we do on X and on other platforms on hate is vitally important. So first of all, we've got to keep doing it. It's really important that we understand the ways that our information ecosystem is being weaponized for commercial reasons to hurt our society, hurt our democracy, hurt science, hurt tolerance, reverse the enlightenment, the counter-enlightenment in action. So that's what we do is salient and important. But the second is that we do have to respond to this in the right way. And I'm just going to read very briefly the end of week email that I sent to my team. I said, this week we won our case against Elon Musk. This was a test of our professionalism and discipline. If we had screwed up at any point and defamed X, they would have sued us for defamation and won. Years ago, we put pre-publication legal review into place and brought a leading legal expert onto our board. If we'd reacted with anger, we might have given the proof of malice, which would have undercut our public interest defense. We did not. We projected confidence and bemusement. If we had panicked, we might have settled. If we didn't have good friends who could help us find good PR advice and good lawyers, we would have failed to defend ourselves. And if we hadn't managed our money carefully, and this is crucial, we would have gone broke. So we did this because we individually make decisions every day to work together to protect the institution of CCDH, its goals, its strategy, its theory of change, and the people we serve against big social media platforms. And that is important. This is a serious job. It requires professionalism and discipline. This is not something to do lightly, nor is it a job that you should do badly. And so we're going to have to tool up and become smarter and wiser in the way that we operate as a sector, but also have the confidence to say what we do matters. And if something matters, it's worth doing well.
Roberta, from your perspective, being someone who has defended folks like Imran in other contexts as well, who are up against power, are there patterns that you see among the folks that you represent who tend to be successful against these types of figures?
I mean, I don't think I can say it any better than what Imran just said himself. It takes, and I'm going to say honestly, if I were Imran, I'm not sure I'd have this quality. I'm not sure I would. But it takes a certain amount of It takes a great amount of self-discipline. It takes an enormous amount of intention, self-esteem, and dignity. And it's a quality that, unfortunately, in our society is often lacking in so many people. And that's understandable given the culture that we live in. But when people like the people who attack Imran go at you so personally and so below the belt and in some ways, I'm going to E. Jean Carroll now, cruelly, it takes just enormous, it takes a very big soul. Let me put it that way. I'm religious, so I'm going to use religious terms. It takes a very big soul to fight back. And CCDH has it. E. Jean Carroll has it. There are others that have it. I think we need, in today's world, a lot more people who have it. Because it's the only way, I think, to really stand up to the insanity that we all live in. And that, and I think, threatens our democracies.
Imran, this disinformation dozen, which was part of the kind of complaint and concern here, it's almost taken on a life well beyond its own in terms of the imagination of your detractors and your critics. If COVID came back around, do you think you'd use the same kind of, I don't know, framework in the way that you approached it in terms of looking at specific super spreaders. Would it, anything be different about your methodology today based on the experience you've had over the last couple of years?
It's a complex question to answer because every one of our research studies is designed to prove to examine a particular point of discussion. So one of the things we know is that social media platforms, that super spreaders have a disproportionately significant impact on the way that disinformation is spread. And I do remember some quotes from Facebook from a while back in which they acknowledged that a small proportion of abusers create a disproportionate amount of the disinformation out there. And we wanted to show that to be true. Now, would we do the same study again? Maybe we'd use the same methodology, maybe not. We tend not to use the same methodology for anyone, for more than one or two of our reports. The truth is that report, we put it out whenever it was, three years ago. Initially, when we put it out, it got a little bit of coverage, and then NPR took it, the White House had it, it became really big. A lot of the times people were reporting it inaccurately. They were saying that 2/3 of the posts are by these people. And we were like, no, 2/3 of the shares, 2/3 of the disinformation being shared on platforms. So that's looking at the links within posts. But my team would get really upset about it. But I'm a great believer in the serenity prayer that there's nothing you can do about the ways in which other people are using your research. You make sure that you put it out with the correct narrative and that you go and explain it in as many places as possible, as accurately as possible. So I'm incredibly proud of the Disinformation Dozen. It was a brilliant piece of work that had a significant impact and helped to show that a small number of bad actors are responsible for a significant amount of the disinformation, the shares, the activity out there on social media, and they can create a large volume because of the way that social media platforms work in which engagement drives amplification and therefore visibility. I'm very happy with that piece of work. And just because some people didn't understand what it meant, it's nothing to do with me, man. Someone else's fault.
I think it is an interesting point that in some ways, and I was trying to allude to this in the question, that it kind of took on a life of its own and perhaps went beyond even what you originally published.
Here's the thing. We've done that again and again as an organization, because we also did that with Deadly by Design, which showed that if you set up an account as a 13-year-old girl on TikTok, within 2.6 minutes, it's giving you eating disorder, and within 8 minutes, self-harm content. We did that with the study that triggered this litigation, which was the study that showed that on X, the use of the N-word tripled after Elon took over the platform. On a daily basis used by that platform. We're like, we are very good at producing those evidence points that people then go and use to prosecute a case against social media platforms. Funnily enough, that's what we see our role as being, of producing the evidence points that get that attention. And we get on the front pages of lots of things. Now, I know a few academics were annoyed about Disinformation Dozen. They said it wasn't a peer-reviewed study. We've never said that. We're not a bunch of academics. We're actually advocates for a more transparent, more accountable, and more responsible social media industry. We're seeking to provide checks and balances on an industry that currently has no oversight whatsoever, no meaningful ways of forcing them to accept responsibility for the negative externalities that they produce. Yeah, I've always felt really calm about it. I know that others don't, but not my problem.
I did note one of the other footnotes in this decision references some research by Coalition for Independent Tech Research, pointing out that its survey of 167 academics and researchers found that over 100 studies about X have, quote, been diverted, stalled, or canceled, with over half of those interviewed citing a fear of being sued by X Corp. Clearly, this has had an effect on perhaps those peer-reviewed researchers thinking about whether or not to go after Twitter on different things.
So it didn't stop us, because we've put out research on X since then. We're putting one out in a few days' time, in fact. Again, we didn't stop us from doing so. And I've always said that there are three types of organizations producing these kinds of studies. One are sort of those organizations that do something else, but the way that social media platforms work affects them. For example, the ADL, the sort of the civil rights organizations, the health organizations, the climate organizations, and they may have thought, look, this is not our primary bit of work. It's ancillary to what we do. And so therefore, we don't want to accept the risk that comes with doing this research. And so a lot of them stop doing it. There's the academic organizations, many of which are run by boards, which frankly are very risk averse, and they've been much more concerned about it. And I think have taken the wrong conclusion in terms of whether or not they should accept the risks and continue to put out the research. And then there are the pure play organizations that operate in the tech accountability space. And it hasn't stopped. And I think CDH is clearly a leading member of that cohort. It didn't stop us at all. And I think it's really important that we don't allow ourselves to be cowed by bullies. In fact, when we talk about trolling, for example, one of the things I say is that trolls are purposeful communicators. They're trying to get you to shut up by using abuse to stop you from communicating. Now, that was our first report ever, actually, Don't Feed the Trolls, the only report that I've written from beginning to end, personally. And why would I not observe the same logic I go and preach to others? They did not silence us at all.
This ruling also came just a couple of weeks after the oral argument in Murthy v. Missouri, another case that, when you dig through the documents, CCDH was, of course, wrapped up in early on, and Disinformation Dozen was a phenomenon. So I suppose, you know, the kind of trajectory of that argument also must have felt like at least something positive, if not a kind of preliminary victory for you as well. But I might ask you, Robbie, like, stepping back from this particular situation, are we seeing a kind of retrenchment essentially in the courts, a kind of coming back to earth around some of the claims that have been made against disinformation researchers? Do you think that will continue as a trend?
I sure hope so. I think it's maybe taken too long, but I think there is certainly a kind of common realization today about the dangers that social media presents to our, again, to our country and to our democracy. The TikTok controversy, as politicized as it's become, I think only highlights that. And so I think much more than in the past, when judges, particularly judges in California, wanted to be very kind of cheerleading when it comes to tech companies, I think the attitude of many judges, and we'll see what the Supreme Court does today, is a much more sober sense based on the past decades of experience and kind of the constant crisis that we see in our society being caused by kind of the lack of responsibility.
Imran, anything to add? Any reflection on Murthy v. Missouri?
Yeah, look, I have quite strong opinions on this, but some of them are kind of orthogonal to the main complaint. I saw that CCDH's research was being cited in Murthy v. Missouri, and they had internal documents from Meta where Meta were panicking over our report and the reception that our report was getting and saying, we need to do something about it. And there were emails between federal government and Meta. Now, my view has always been that the government shouldn't be taking a position on what we can say and think. I am actually I'm a liberal. I believe in free speech. I believe in people having the right to decide what they say. But I do believe in a strong civil society that's able to hold people responsible when they are spreading hate and lies. Funnily enough, I'm not particularly religious myself. In fact, I'm not religious at all, but I do believe in right and wrong, good and evil. And I think that lying and making people feel fearful or abusing them for their identity is evil too. And I don't think the federal government should get involved in promoting or trying to create consequences for CCDH research. We're very good at doing that ourselves. What I think government should be doing is providing a framework, a statutory framework for transparency of these companies, which is really what this case was all about. It was them trying to hide the way that they behave. And companies don't have a complete right to privacy. I run a 501c3. Do you know how much paperwork I have to fill in every year? It's insane how many things I have to divulge to the federal government. And I'm completely calm with that. It's a lot of work. It costs a lot with accountants and lawyers and everything else. But I'm fine with having to do that. These companies, however, believe that they should be completely opaque and that no one has the right to understand how they work. And that is nonsense. So I think that government should be enabling a partnership between civil society and the state, users, the voters, and these companies, by creating the mechanisms by which they can be made transparent and by which they can be held accountable. And so Murthy v. Missouri, yes, I'm glad to see that the government is allowed to communicate to social media companies when there's an exigent harm. I do see the rationale for that. But I think generally speaking, government should understand its role, and its role is to help us do our job better in civil society.
I would go a step farther, and you should have endorsed this if you disagree. It's not a statement from you at all. But I think the other big problem, and there's no surprises here, the other big problem that we have is that no other industry in our country is completely immunized for the harm that it causes. And it is ridiculous. It is literally ridiculous that children are dying, literally committing suicide daily across this country because of abuse on Facebook and bad actors using Facebook and other platforms to freak out, scare, and extort young children. That's absurd. And these companies need to be, I know there's going to be need to some legislation to really make it last, but there needs to be accountability. And just like companies don't have complete rights to privacy, they don't have complete rights not to be accountable for the harm that they cause.
Yeah, and that's what the civil justice system is there for, is that when companies create those negative externalities, those harms to people or society, that they can be asked to pay restitution or to fix the problem that they've caused. And the fact that these companies are not subject to negligence law, product design liability law, in the same way that any American company would be, has created a culture of impunity that you can see the end result of it. You can see these weird tyrannical figures running around demanding that the courts enforce laws that they've invented against their critics, and at the same time saying that they should never be, that they should be beyond even moral criticism, because the legal impunity with which they've enjoyed because of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act 1996 has now turned itself into some sort of belief that they are morally immune from being held responsible for the harms that they cause. And that's unacceptable. We do need to reverse that as soon as possible. And I think I've been in London for a few weeks. Before that, I was in San Francisco and LA. I went to see Arturo Bejar in Oakland. And Arturo is the whistleblower at Meta who came out with revelations about a survey. One of the findings was that in the past 7 days, 1 in 8 children has had an unwanted sexual advance on one of Meta's platforms. In the past 7 days, that's what they were finding. And that he put forward recommendations for dozens of things that could be done to make that less likely to happen. He sent it to Mark Zuckerberg himself, among others, and that Meta's leadership shelved that report and didn't implement the recommendations. And when you see that kind of stuff, you have to ask yourself, in what world should that decision-making be treated as third-party communications for the purposes of Section 230? These companies are literally getting away with murder.
I want to be clear. I do not believe that Section 230 protects product design or product defect cases. It's an issue that's currently being litigated. Stay tuned in that space, but I don't think they're protected that far, even though they, of course, think they are.
I assume that neither of you are for the repeal of Section 230, but for seeing it narrowed.
We've been really clear at CCDH. We're revolutionaries for reasonableness, that as long as these companies act in a reasonable way, they should enjoy the protection of Section 230. But where they fail to do so, there should be a reasonable actor test attached to that immunity. That opens the door for negligence law to be reasserted against these companies. And that's what people like Marianne France and Daniel Citron have talked about. We're having our follow-up to the STAR conference where we developed our STAR framework in June this year in Washington. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how thinking is advanced on that. But no, I don't think we should repeal Section 230, but I don't think it can remain intact in the way that it exists at the moment.
Robbie, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'm just a small town lawyer here in New York City. So I'm going to defer to Imran on that. Other than I agree that the kind of really radical protection and immunity it offers is unheard of in any other industry and obviously needs to be reconsidered.
What's next for you? What is on the agenda? What can we expect out of the center?
I think that given this year is the year of elections around the world, 2.5 billion people are going to vote in elections around the world, including right here in the United States. We're doing some work looking at AI and the way that whether or not they've got the guardrails in place to ensure that they aren't abused and create chaos in our information ecosystem during an essential election year. We're going to be looking as well at the way that women are being treated in this election and the way that abuse is used to vitiate their fundamental rights to speak by the way that it works on social media. As Robbie and anyone else will tell you, is that the second that you jump on there, you face a wall of abuse that makes you want to just put your head back under your blanket and not speak. Well, maybe not Robbie, because she's, you know, robust, shall we say. That's the posh word for it. We're doing that. We've got other research looking at post October the 7th rises, in particular in anti-Semitism and other forms of hatred, including Islamophobia, on social media platforms, because that's vital. I think that the situation for my Jewish friends is the worst it's been in my lifetime. I'm 45. I cannot remember a time when my Jewish friends have been as scared and felt as overwhelmed by a wall of abuse as they have in the last few months since October the 7th, since those atrocious attacks by Hamas in Israel. And then we'll continue doing the rest of our work. We're particularly interested in the damage on kids. And last year we launched a PSA with the Entertainment Industry Foundation, which received 1 billion views over that year, airing on networks and cable channels all over America. We're launching a new version of that, and we've updated our protectingkidsonline.org website with the parents guide. So I'm really looking forward to going out and talking to people about how parents can protect their kids more effectively on social media platforms by having symmetrical conversations in which kids are telling them about what they're seeing and parents are helping them contextualize it. There's a huge array of work. And then growing CCDH. Look, last year we went from 15 to 30 staff. This year we're going to grow again. We have been consistently growing year on year by between 75 and 100% a year for the last 4 years. We're going to continue growing this year. I'm looking forward to going out and building that team, making the case and making sure that CCDH can be an institution that provides a permanent solution to the question of who will provide checks and balances to this out of control industry.
Robbie, I suppose I'll put a last question to you. You have a habit of defending folks against billionaires. Doesn't seem like billionaires are on their way out anytime soon. If you step back from it all, what have you learned about taking on people with this degree of resources, and what do you think we can expect for the rest of the decade?
So let me begin by saying you're right. I do have I've developed a reputation for taking on billionaires or people who say they are billionaires. There must be a certain amount of craziness within me that has me keep on doing this. But look, I think cases like this one, the decision by Judge Breyer here and others, reaffirms my belief that in this country, we have a legal system that allows you to fight back, and that reinforces fundamental beliefs like the rule of law and freedom of speech and other qualities that I think too many people think are nostalgic silliness today, but they're neither nostalgic nor silly. They're important. I intend to keep doing that. That's what I've gotten into doing, and I don't see a stop to it anytime soon. Sorry, Imran, go ahead.
Robbie knows this because she knows I'm very silly in real life, and she knows that. My wife is American, and I love the clash of cultures. But the first thing I did when I heard the result was I stood up, I put both my arms in the air, and I started chanting in London, USA! 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 Makes me proud to be an American.
Well, on that note, I thank you both for taking the time to explain to me a little bit about your reactions to this ruling and a little bit about your work more generally. I wish you well. Talk to you again soon, I hope.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thanks.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones, and thank you for listening.
Policy Press.